This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewarts, and coming up, how climate change could have a dramatic impact on the maritime boundaries that separate the islands of the Pacific. Why is it that there are so few women MPs in Pacific Island governments? And the Royal Tonga Ski Federation says there may be no snow at home, but they are sure there is winter sports talent.
I pray that soon enough I can be able to get government on board with promoting and getting more kids to the snow. We've got New Zealand and Australia. They're very easy to take kids over there to train.
Those stories to come a little later. But first, the former president of Nauru, Sprint Dabodeau, has put himself at the mercy of the Australian government as he seeks life-saving medical treatment, which he insists his own government have gone out of their way to deny him. Mr. Dabodeau says the Nauruan government would prefer to see him 6 foot under, even though officially they have said overseas treatment for the country's former leader was approved in July last year. The alarm bells first rang for ex-President Dabodeau in March 2018 when a visiting medical team from Taiwan told him he needed to have a CT scan on a tumour in his neck as a matter of urgency. But in the hands of the Nauruan Health Service, the process was long and drawn out, culminating in advice to Mr. Dabodeau that the results of the scan would have to be sent to Fiji for diagnosis, and those results could take a month to come back. As the saga continued, Mr. Dabodeau, already one of the defendants in the long-running Nauru 19 case, has told Pacific Beat that the police turned up at his door and laid fresh charges against him, only for magistrates to rule that there was no case to answer. Eventually, official approval was given for Mr. Dabodeau to go to India for treatment, but when the Department of Health asked for his passport to complete the process, he declined. It had taken many weeks for him to locate his passport and get it returned after a court ruling in his favour, and he wasn't prepared to surrender it again, arguing that the health department had already been dragging their feet for months.
She said, could you not take the passport because it's going to take 2 weeks to get a visa from India. So I said, no, it's too late. You know, we're talking about in 2 weeks, September. And I gave you this passport sometime in May or something like that, and you've been running around. So I took the passport, and just to make sure that they don't stop me at the airport, I bought a ticket on Friday morning at about 5 a.m. and I took off.
That flight took Mr. Dabodeau to Bangkok, but instead of undergoing cancer treatment, the money he had set aside was swallowed up by an emergency operation to remove his gallbladder. But prior to his departure, he says he was told by a department official in Nauru that he would be reimbursed.
So I called on to Nauru to start getting reimbursement. The word that came out from Nauru was, because I took my passport and left on my own, then I'm on my own.
While all this was going on, the case against the Nauru 19 on riot charges had been thrown out on appeal, and the Nauruan government was castigated for persecuting Mr. Dabodeau and his fellow defendants, a state of affairs which he was told gave the ex-president the option of seeking help from Australia.
The lawyers said, hey, the judgment on your criminal case has come out scathing against your government. With that judgment, you may be able to seek protection in Australia and get treated while you're under that protection. I've filed for protection, and while I'm waiting for that to be finalised, I have been able to get on Medicare, and the treatment has started.
So matters now rest with the Australian Home Affairs Department, but with avenues of appeal open to him, Mr. Dabodeau is hoping his treatment can be completed, even if in the end his case is rejected.
I'm in the hands of the Australian Immigration Department. If they approve my protection, then I think there's a good chance I stay here for 2 years or a bit more. But if not approved, then I suppose I'll be on the next flight out.
Meanwhile, questions remain over why the Nauruan Department of Health put the country's ex-president in such a position in the first place. Dr. James Auto has recently taken up the post of head of medical services, and he has reiterated the government line on what Mr. Dabodeau opted to do, regardless of the reasons he cites for doing it.
If Nauruan shows treatment overseas outside of this Department of Health processes, then those are the private arrangements.
Are you able to explain why there was a delay of that magnitude?
I cannot comment to you on that.
Do you acknowledge, though, that this process did go on for many months before the former president decided to take matters into his own hands?
No, I will make no such acknowledgement.
And as far as the health department in Nauru is concerned, are you no longer involved in what happens to the former president and his treatment, or could he yet have his costs covered by the Nauruan government?
I will also be unable to make any comment to your question.
Has there been any contact between the department and former President Davido in recent times?
If contact is made other than at my level of Director of Medical Services, then I will myself be able to know.
But it's Sprint Davido's belief that the Nauruan government never intended to allow him to go overseas for treatment that they would fund.
I think they prefer me to be 6 foot underneath the ground. The way they have treated me, they refused to acknowledge that I have cancer. They were in court saying, no, I have to stay in Nauru and cannot fly for medical treatment because the court case is ongoing. So they rather I stay for the court case and die there than get treated. These people call themselves leaders, but in my view, they're worse than evil.
Ex-president of Nauru, Sprint Davido, on the line from Sydney. And Radio Australia has asked the Australian Home Affairs Department for a status update on Mr. Davido's application for a protection visa, but we were told they don't comment on individual cases. Now, we often hear that climate change poses an existential threat to the Pacific Island nations, but it could also wreak havoc with the political geography of the Pacific Ocean. Pacific leaders are worried that rising sea levels could swamp many of the features used to determine the region's maritime boundaries. So now, as Stephen Jedgetts reports, officials are gathering for the first time to figure out a way of tackling that problem.
Most Pacific islands are tiny specks of land, but that doesn't mean that they're small countries. Many of them also control vast swathes of ocean, which dwarf their modest land holdings. Josh Mitchell works for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in the nation of Cook Islands.
We have something like 600 square kilometres of land versus 2 million square kilometres of oceans.
Determining who owns what in this huge aquatic realm hasn't been easy. Maritime boundaries are normally pegged to often isolated shards of land, islands, atolls, reefs and rocks, which barely poke above sea level. And scientists warn that climate change will bring rising seas, which could swamp these features in coming decades. Here's Josh Mitchell again.
You are generating these maritime jurisdiction areas from areas of land. And if you lose that land, does that mean you consequently lose the maritime jurisdiction? So that's the question that we're looking at.
Scientists and geologists have been mulling solutions for years, but this week Pacific bureaucrats and experts have met at Sydney University, marking the first time that government officials have gathered to begin the laborious process of sketching out what a political solution might look like. And Josh Mitchell says they've got a blank canvas to work with.
The founding document that allowed all of our countries to claim maritime jurisdiction was the Law of the Sea. The Law of the Sea didn't really contemplate climate change and sea level rise in any meaningful way, so the law is largely silent.
One option is to agree to simply fix the existing survey points on a map, even if they do disappear underwater eventually. But doing that means convincing Pacific states who might spot advantages in the shifting landscape not to press their claims. It's even more complicated when it comes to disputed borders. The Deputy Director General of the Pacific Community, Dr. Audrey Omoa, says she believes Pacific nations will prize collaboration instead of competition.
The spirit in which the Pacific has particularly worked to achieve the current goals of maritime boundaries success has been on the principle of cooperation, and I would tend to think that that would be the continued spirit in which they would work for the Pacific. This is a really important principle.
Either way, the stakes are high. Pacific fisheries are worth more than $1 billion and are a crucial source of income for the region. Dr. Omoa says boundaries determine who can fish where, so any shifts could have significant consequences.
The Pacific relies quite a lot on its fisheries industry, and for that reason, the economic benefits of making sure that we've got boundaries delineated are very important.
Josh Mitchell is optimistic but says the region must hammer out a solution.
There's no question that economically and comparatively speaking, we have far more to lose than most other larger countries.
Once again, small nations are at the pointy end of a global problem.
Stephen Jedgetts reporting, and you're listening to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. Nearly 2 weeks after Sione Feimoefiafi was beaten to death in a Tongan bar, a graphic video depicting his final moments is still up on Facebook. And since 5 men have been charged by the police, questions are being asked about what purpose is really served by broadcasting a man's death on social media. The Attorney General's office in Nuku'alofa has issued a public notice expressing serious concern over the level of public commentary prompted by the Facebook video. So exactly how does the social media platform regulate the posting of videos with the power to cause shock and distress? Priyanka Srinivasan has been finding out.
The video can be difficult to watch. A man is repeatedly punched and kicked inside a bar in Tonga's capital, Nuku'alofa, before being dragged outside onto the road. 49-year-old Sione Feimoefiafi died soon after the brawl. He had travelled to Tonga to attend his father's funeral. The video of the fatal attack on Sione's life has taken on a life of its own, racking up tens of thousands of views on Facebook alone. But for his grieving family, the video has only added to their distress, and Jailate Feimoefiafi, Sione's wife, is particularly concerned about the effect the video may have on her 3 children.
It's just been horrific. I mean, the news was shocking and only made worse, obviously, amplified by the fact that there was this video, and then that video generated so much social media attention.
But it's unclear whether the video could be taken down by Facebook, even if the family wanted that to happen. The social media giant's controversial policies allow the distribution of graphic or violent content, as long as it does not celebrate violence. But Facebook has come under fire in the past for allowing extreme content, such as beheadings, to be broadcast on their platform. In a statement to Pacific Beat, a Facebook spokesperson responded to concerns about the Tongan brawl video still being available online.
This is a terrible incident and our thoughts are with the family. We do not allow people to celebrate or glorify crimes on Facebook, though in some instances when people share this type of content, they are doing so to condemn violence or raise awareness about an issue. In this case, the video was posted to condemn an act of violence, which is why we placed a warning screen over the content and limited its accessibility to people over 18.
The issue is gaining more attention in the Pacific region as Facebook usage also grows. A number of similar cases have been recorded where graphic images are shared via the social media site, and as a result, some people are calling for tougher regulation of online content. Several Pacific countries, including Samoa, Papua New Guinea and Fiji, have considered policies to do just that. Jason Titifanui from the University of South Pacific is currently researching the ability for such regulation to curtail violence online.
At this point in time, governments are attempting to regulate and carry out regulations, but what is worrying is that in many cases, not just in the Pacific but around the world, where the ostensibly great motives of protecting the populace from gruesome images or to stop the circulation of child pornography can be used as a veil for basic censorship.
Though Mr. Titifanui says there are no apparent cases of this type of censorship in the Pacific, he believes public education is a more effective way to combat the circulation of violence online. As for Sione Feimoefiafi's family, they've decided to simply ignore the video online and focus instead on remembering their lost loved one. Pacific Beat approached the user who posted the video on Facebook, but he was unexpectedly unavailable at the agreed-upon time for the interview.
That report compiled by Priyanka Srinivasan. The number of countries around the world where at least half of their MPs are women can be counted on the fingers of one hand. And even then, you only need 3 fingers because Rwanda, Cuba and Bolivia are the only nations that pass muster. Australia is nowhere near the 50% figure, and in the Pacific it's still very hard to find any female parliamentarians at all, with 10 in Fiji, 5 in Samoa, 2 in Tonga, just 1 in Solomon Islands, none at all in Papua New Guinea and Vanuatu. So, what's the problem and what can be done to increase the number of females in Pacific parliaments? Pacific Morning's Lauren Beldy has been looking for answers.
There were plenty of women in Papua New Guinea's official election awareness song ahead of the 2017 vote. And there were a record 167 female candidates that contested the election. But not a single one of them made it into parliament. Even the 3 incumbent female MPs all lost their seats. Former public servant Cassie Sawang ran for a seat in Medang province.
I would like to call upon the members of parliament, there's 111 of them out there, to just remember that there are no women in there. And I want them to become advocates for us. So when it comes 2022, at least we can have one woman to be in parliament.
It's not just Papua New Guinea that has a problem. Although women make up roughly half the world's population, that ratio is reflected in very few parliaments around the world. In Australia, for example, only 29% of MPs in the lower house were women at the last election. The country is ranked number 51 out of 193 by the Interparliamentary Union. The US, meanwhile, is at 75, tied with Montenegro. Kiribati is at 176, Solomon Islands is at 186, and Vanuatu joins PNG in currently having no women in parliament at all. The country representative for UN Women in Samoa, Meli Moala, says the Pacific is one of the worst when it comes to the proportion of female MPs.
The stats are about 7.3% as of March of last year. I know that there have been some increases through elections that we've had most recently, but that's still a very low number in relation to other parts of the world.
Some of the barriers to greater participation of women are not always obvious to voters.
Each country has its own electoral process, its own electoral system, and there can be biases that can be created through those electoral processes, like first past the post. So I don't think a lot of people even realize that that can actually disenfranchise women from running through that process. But by the same token, you know, we have a lot of cultural, social, and religious norms, values, and beliefs, practices, etc., that can also create an environment which discourages women for even contemplating running. And that then, of course, makes it difficult for voters, whether they be male or female, to envisage a woman in a decision-making role.
Compared to its neighbours, Fiji is doing better. A record 10 women were elected to the 51-member parliament last November. That included lawyer and opposition MP Linda Tambuya, who raised the issue of gender equality in her inaugural speech.
As Assistant Shadow for the Attorney General and Minister for Justice, I would like to see more women judges and magistrates in our judiciary. And on this note, I would like to thank the head of the judiciary, who will be retiring very soon, His Lordship, the current Chief Justice, Anthony Gates. Thank you for your service to Fiji. I also wish to congratulate my fellow women members of Parliament who continue to shatter the glass ceiling and give hope to achieve more gender equality and gender participation on a national level.
But despite her words, when the new parliament opened, it was her outfit that drew the most attention. Ms. Tambuya faced criticism from other members, including women in her own party, for wearing a dress with a hemline slightly above the knee.
I felt there was going to be someone who would comment on it coming from the public, but this came from within my own party, and this also came from my own male colleagues in the party. So I was disappointed, and for me it wasn't an issue at all as long as I met the parliamentary dress code, which I did.
But plenty of Fijian men and women also rallied to her defence online. And Meli Moala says attitudes to women are slowly changing for the better.
We have our first female president, Hilda Heine, in the Marshall Islands, who is still in office. And of course, we have our first deputy prime minister here in Samoa, Fiamme Mataafa. So we definitely have some distinct changes in terms of the level and number of women that are representing. It's just not reflective in terms of comparison to other regions.
And there are plenty of organizations seeking to tip the scales towards gender equality in Pacific politics. The United Nations Development Programme runs practice parliaments for women candidates in several Pacific countries. At home, Meli Moala is working on a project called Women in Leadership in Samoa.
That's a project for about 3.5 years, which will be helping change attitudes not only towards women in political participation, but just across the board in terms of making sure that young women can envisage themselves potentially following a political path, that women who are mid-level in terms of their careers can also imagine, not only if I'm running for office, how do I have to strategize for that? What are the tools that I'm going to need? As well as encouraging women who are also holding parliamentary seats at this time, encouraging them to inform and share with others about how women can then run for office as well.
The Solomon Islands, which currently has only one female MP in its 50-seat parliament, will go to the polls at the start of April. Vanuatu, meanwhile, will vote in a year's time. Papua New Guinea's next election is still 3 years away.
That's Lauren Beldy from the Pacific Mornings team, and I'm Richard Hewitt, and you're listening to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. After a serious knee injury wrecked his chances of making history by becoming Tonga's first ever Olympic alpine skier last year, Kasete Skeen is back on the slopes in his new European home, and he's more determined than ever to represent the country of his heritage at the Games in China in 2022. Meanwhile, the Royal Tonga Ski Federation has a plan to take some young Tongans with winter sports aspirations out of the country and put them to the test on snow. But it was the moment of truth for Kasete Skeen when he took to the snow again for the first time. Not unnaturally, there was some apprehension, but he says that feeling didn't last for long.
The first fall was a bit of a test, but since then I haven't really looked back. I think because I did what the doctors said and I did my work in the gym before, it felt really good.
So back in harness, Kasete is gearing up for the qualifying rounds of this year's World Championship, where he'll compete in the giant slalom. And the president of the Royal Tonga Ski Federation, Leafa Mataeli-Warwick, says she has already noticed a change in focus.
He's more driven now. He could see himself making it to the Olympics, but there was so many obstacles and then the injuries on top of it. And so it took him down, but this time he's more focused. We do see a big change there and we're pretty proud.
Since suffering his injury, Kasete Skeen has moved from the UK to Scandinavia, mainly so he can be near the snow most of the time, and the Tonga team manager and coach Steve Grundman has been dispatched from his base in Germany to help the skier step up his training regime.
I'm actually living here in the north of Sweden now, so that's given me some good opportunities to train and practice as well.
Living there, working there, you've learnt the language as well, so while your knee was on the mend, you've become Swedish, essentially.
Yeah, kind of. It's a good place, and they've been very welcoming to me over here, so I'm enjoying life up here in the frozen north.
At this point, we're going to try to push him to do some more training, at least 2.5 hours a day versus what he's doing now. So that would only build his stamina and get him speed.
Two other young Tongan skiers are training elsewhere in Europe at the moment, but over the next couple of years, the hope is that more winter sports athletes will join them from Tonga itself.
There's a lot going on back in Tonga with government issues and stuff, in which I pray that soon enough I can be able to get them on board with promoting and getting more kids to the snow. We've got New Zealand, Australia, they're very easy to take kids over there to train.
As for cross-country skier Peter Tafutafua, who made his second bare-chested appearance at an opening ceremony in Pyeongchang last year, it's understood he's training for another crack at the Summer Olympics, this time in Tokyo and this time on the water. But Leafa Mataeli-Warwick says the athlete has also pledged his allegiance to the ski team.
Right now he's training and he's training hard. And if anybody can do it, Peter can. I know it. I've seen him do it. Don't be surprised if he's going to pull it off. But regardless, he is on board with us and he has not left Royal Tonga Ski. We're backing him and supporting him 100%. But at the same time, we know that his heart is with the Tonga Ski team and he's pretty much promised us for a return to get ready for Beijing.
And the Winter Games in Beijing could also see the return of Tonga's first Winter Games competitor, luger Bruno Banani.
Beijing would be awesome return for Bruno. I'm keeping my fingers crossed for one run for Bruno, one more time, and then he can retire. I work very closely with New Zealand, and I work very closely with the Australian luge team. So I'm hoping, because we do have all the natural tracks there, that maybe I can start bringing some kids to the snow and help out, because also the IOC really, really, really go out of their way to support us. They do see that we're serious about this, and we will grow.
Well, the hope is that one day a Tongan-born athlete will represent the Pacific Island country at a Winter Games. For now, the team is made up entirely of competitors with Tongan heritage who have grown up elsewhere in the world. But Kasete Skeen says that heritage matters.
Sadly, there are no skiing mountains in Tonga, but the road through all of this has led me back there again, which was great. I was back there at the end of 2017 with my family and with everyone, so that was cool.
And as he prepares to go into action in his newly adopted home country of Sweden this week, Kasete Skeen sounds confident and on track with his Olympic dream that might actually be within reach now.
My level is going up quite quickly again. When I was skiing before, actually, during the last World Championships, I had a broken hand and that affected me more than I realised. So now I'm skiing injury free and I'm skiing with the freedom that I didn't quite have before.
Tonga's would-be Olympic skier Kasete Skeen on the line from his new base in northern Sweden. And that's it from this edition of Pacific Review. You can listen to the program on demand by subscribing to our podcast. I'm Richard Hewitt, and thank you very much for listening.